Welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast, show number 75 with Justin from Saving Sherpa.
I met these little cooking commandments, and the first one is your freezer is sacred, because that freezer space should be just stock full of every time you can find meat dirt cheap, unless you're a vegetarian, obviously. Like, that's what I'm using my freezer for. Like, it's not going to be full of all kinds of random boxes of stuff that take up a bunch of room. It's going to be nothing but straight, just dirt cheap meat that I find on sale.
It's time for a new American dream, one that doesn't involve working in a cubicle for 40 years, barely scraping by. Whether you're looking to get your financial house in order, invest the money you already have, or discover new paths for wealth creation, you're in the right place. This show is for anyone who has money or wants more. This is the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast.
How's it going, everybody? I'm Scott Trench. I'm here with my co-host, Miss Mindy Jensen. How are you doing today, Mindy?
Scott, I'm having a great day. How are you doing?
I am doing fantastic. I was very, you know, I really enjoyed talking with Justin here and hearing his story about just an all-out approach. He calls it a lazy approach. I guess it is really a lazy approach, financial independence, but hard work and discipline and just designing a life that that were very efficient were all kind of key components in this.
Yeah, it's not the laziest path to FI. It's the most efficient path to FI. I love what he says, and he says this right at the very beginning of the show. He says, I am always looking to squeeze the most out of a dollar. And then during the course of the show, he gives you like 87 examples of how he actually squeezes the most out of every dollar that comes in. And his story is kind of inspiring. I don't think that somebody listening is going to say, oh, well, he's just a kid. No, I'm going to take lessons from this and I'm going to apply them to my life too. I love his Were there five tenets of grocery shopping?
I think there were six or seven.
Six or seven, even better. Yeah. I love those. Every one of those I can put into application in my life. So, you know, it's a great episode. He talks a lot about saving money on groceries. He tells the story of how he found his dirt cheap apartment in Boston and how he just doesn't spend a lot of money and still lives a really rich and full life.
Yeah, I think the key context to keep in mind is he's a late 20-something guy who's really kind of optimized this path toward FI from an income and savings perspective, really since high school, and kind of figuring out the college thing from there. And it's just a very efficient mover towards that in, I think, a really repeatable way for folks. You don't have to create a business to follow this approach. You don't have to invest in real estate. You can just save and invest, and you're going to get to the end goal very quickly if you follow his approach.
Yeah, what did he say? 7 or 8 years?
Yep.
That's awesome.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right. Get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED lights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time. Every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Deciding how to invest your capital can be extremely challenging, especially when the market is constantly changing. That's why it's never been more important to partner with a company that has a great track record. The BAM Capital executive team has successfully navigated through the Great Recession, COVID-19, and the current interest rate environment while delivering maximized returns to their partners. BAM Capital is a trusted multifamily syndicator with over $1.3 billion in transactions, delivering a historical average of over 35% IRR with an average hold period of 3.5 years. BAM Capital has consistently paid preferred return distributions for over 50 consecutive months, has not lost limited partners capital, and has not called capital past the subscription amount. BAM Capital's disciplined investment strategy is targeting undermanaged institutional quality trophy assets throughout the U.S. heartland for accredited investors who are looking for generational wealth building or monthly income opportunities. Their offerings target cash flow stability, capital preservation, long-term appreciation, and accelerated tax benefits. Join BAM Capital's over 1,200 investors across 44 states and get started today at BAMCapital.com. Again, that's BAMCapital.com.
Justin Taylor from Saving Sherpa. Welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks you guys for having me on.
I'm so excited you're here. I should say Justin from Saving Sherpa and the FI Show.
Thank you. Yeah, we're trying to put in some good work on the podcast too.
Yeah, and you host that with Cody Berman, who was a guest on our episode. Oh, goodness, I bring this up and then I don't even have the number handy. 39, I think, was Cody's episode. We'll link to his episode in the show notes. Although you have to be better because it's a competition. Everything's okay. A competition.
I mean, I'm pretty much better than him in every way, but.
right. Perfect.
What a great start to the show. So Justin, can you walk us through where your journey with money begins? Because I want to get your mindset going into it. And then I definitely want to touch on your grocery shopping habits because they're pretty impressive.
Sure. So I think to kind of understand where I'm coming from and my background, it starts from a very young age. I grew up in a very small town in Mississippi. So, you know, that comes with all those connotations of, you know, the public education system there and the kind of income levels you're talking about. My parents got divorced when I was 8. So then it was just me and my mom on a single income where she was a furniture factory worker. Probably around age 11 or 12, she stops working for a little less than a year ago, back to cosmetology school to kind of change careers. And during that year, I mean, we had zero income and we were living on pretty much no savings. And so, you know, I've got this uncle who's working at a grocery store who's like, hey, here's these like 5-pound tubes of ground beef that are going out of date. Like y'all can have these, mix that with some noodles, like trying to figure out how to scrounge by. And we kind of gamified it though. You know, I know that's popular to kind of get people on board with different programs. Like, we just tried to make it fun and not an actual keeping up with points system, but it was a competition to us and we kind of took to that. And ever since then, you know, I've just always been really intrigued by how do you squeeze the most out of a dollar and not so much not cutting something out of your life, but how do you keep that same amount of experience and enjoyment out of something without spending any more money?
Are you saying that you were gamifying what the most creative meal you could make out of freebies or stuff that was extremely cheap? Is that what was that the game system you're describing?
So yeah, I guess I just mean like we were kind of taking it with like a badge of honor. We were having fun with it. Like it didn't seem like oh man, this is like all we have, and we're kind of depressed about it. Like we kind of was like, hey, you know, we were able to get this many meals for this price. Let's try to get more for that price. Or hey, we need to get clothes for school. We got this kind of budget. How much stuff can we get? Like just trying to maximize everything. We looked at it, tried to look at it through a more positive lens, I would say. And from that point, things pretty standard. Get ready to graduate high school. I approached my parents and were like, hey, you know, how much money have you guys saved up for college? So I know what the delta is. So I can go try to figure that out. They just kind of gave me blank stares. And so I knew the answer was zero. So go to my guidance counselor in high school and say, okay, I'd like to go straight to a university, trying to get out of the small town. I was a little scared of stopping at the community college because I was just a little afraid I'd get stuck in that small town. So I said, hey, I want to go straight to the university. What can I do? Like, help me out. And he looked at me and said, if you want to put your parents in debt for the rest of their life, I won't be a part of it. I was like, well, that's not really guidance counselor advice.
But no, you know what? That's really good advice. Although I don't know that it would have been your parents going into the debt, you would be old enough to sign for those papers yourself. So you'd be the one getting all that debt.
So I guess, you know, if you said like that was the only option, it is either A, you can't leave this small town, you have to go to this community college, or B, you can go to a university and put but there is definitely a lot of in between there.
I see what you're saying. He painted a black and white picture.
Right, with no help, with no like, here is the pros and cons, or here's something you could do. And so that kind of honestly was one of the best experiences I've ever had in my life. Like he told me I couldn't do it. So therefore I was going to do it. And so I went and I took the ACT 7 times so I could get my score high enough, because I saw there was this one scholarship in particular in the state of Mississippi that really made a big jump once you got a 29 on your ACT. So I took it 7 times until I got that 29. And then that was enough to get me all of my tuition paid for. So then I was looking at is kind of pay for room and board, meals, that sort of stuff. And then one of my buddies talked me into doing an Air Force ROTC interview. And I ended up doing it, getting a high school scholarship, which looking back, only about 10% of people who are in ROTC are actually on a scholarship, at least in the Air Force. And anyways, that ended up giving me enough money to pay for tuition again, plus room and board, plus meals. So I was pocketing thousands of dollars every year by going to college. And so that's kind of where I got started.
Oh, we got to stop here because I didn't even know about this part of your story. Okay, so we had a military person on just a couple of weeks ago, Sarah P., and somebody sent me a note, actually a couple of military people, and people have sent me notes. Oh, you can't do that. You can't do this. When the government is giving you money for tuition, they just give you, here's a pile of cash or a check or whatever. And that's yours to spend as you please. Is that how that works?
Pretty much. There's kind of like a middleman factor with the school. So I was getting like FAFSA or whatever, like the income dependent kind of financial aid. Okay. I was getting scholarships for my ACT and that sort of stuff. And then I was also getting money from the Air Force. All that money goes to the financial office at the college. And so just like a credit card, right? Like if you had bought something on your credit card and then they returned it, like that money just goes back into that account. And if you overpay your credit card, then all of a sudden there's a plus up and then they return that to you. So I would just go to the financial aid office at the end of every semester. And they're like, here's a check for, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is.
And the government didn't ask for that back. Like I'm not in the military and I've never gone through the military schooling system. So that's just yours. They will give you, let's call it $5,000 a semester to go to school. And if you only cost you $4,000, you just get an extra $1,000. That sounds brilliant.
So what they're doing is they're just like, here is what tuition costs. We're paying what tuition costs. They don't know that you also are getting scholarship money from another avenue. You know, that system doesn't talk to each other. It doesn't say, hey, which, you know, also honestly wouldn't be fair. Like, right, if I didn't do anything, I never applied for a scholarship in any other manner, but then the Air Force decides to pay for it. Like, that doesn't really seem fair. Like, I busted my tail to get those scholarships. I feel like I should get them both. But it is an important delineation because I went to ROTC, which is where I go to a normal college, and then I'm doing my program at that normal state school. If I would have went to the Air Force Academy, for instance, like they're not going to give you an academic scholarship because it's free already. So you can't make money there. Whereas I was making money at the state school going to ROTC.
So this is an interesting situation. So I get a scholarship, I go to college, and I join the military in an ROTC program, which gives me free tuition. So there's more money going into the college education fund than is needing to be spent. So I get that money at the end of every semester. And is this something that's repeatable for many other people, I guess, is the question, right? Is this something that like could a high schooler today go do that and make money while attending college? Now, of course, the trade-off here, by the way, let's put that in there, throw that out there, is that you are required to do a certain amount of years of service in the Air Force following graduation, right?
So here's I would say a couple of things that I want to clarify with what you just said. So I don't want it to sound like black and white that if you join Air Force ROTC, you get your college paid for. Like I said in the beginning, I did an interview process. I got what they call a high school scholarship that's paying for your full tuition throughout the 4 to 5 years, depending on what your major is and all that sort of stuff. Only about 10%. So like in my intro class, like my freshman class, there's about 6 of us got that scholarship. It's not, they don't just hand those out like candy for the Air Force. I've heard it's a little easier in other services. Now, the other part of that is, do you owe time afterwards? Yes, if. So with that high school scholarship, you actually have your full freshman year to make up your mind. So as long as you cut off the scholarship before you start your sophomore year, you don't owe any time. And that was actually my intention. My intention was, I'm going to take their money for a year, and then I'm going to quit. Like, sure, I'm doing some ROTC stuff, no big deal. And then I'm going to quit that program. I won't owe them any of that money back. And then, you know, I'm on my own for years 2, 3, and 4, but I actually ended up you know, really enjoying the program and stayed with it.
Okay. So to answer Scott's question, it sounds like this is repeatable with an asterisk. Like you have to qualify for the scholarship. You have to earn the scholarship. You have to earn all this. But then once you earn it, this is a repeatable thing. I could not ever get a scholarship because I was a terrible student, but Scott was an excellent student. So Scott, you could have gotten 27 scholarships. And then I think that with just piling up scholarships, it might not work this way, but with the scholarship and the Air Force part, it would work this way, which is just a really brilliant hack that we haven't talked about before.
And I think what's remarkable to point out here is it sounds like, Justin, you've come from a fairly low income environment growing up, and that you got very intentional about having a really low cost, free, net negative college experience early in high school. I bet you, I would imagine, and got that together early on in that high school process, maybe those junior, senior year or before. Is that accurate?
So it was around, you know, my junior year. You normally do the interview process between your junior and senior year. And again, I never had any intentions to join the military. I feel like now that I'm in the military, I can say things like this. But when I was in high school, I thought all the military was knocking down doors overseas for 18 grand a year. I had this whole thing of what I thought the military was. It turns out that is as far from the truth as humanly possible for a lot of people. And that is true for some people, unfortunately. But yes, I did that between my 11th and 12th grade. And like you said, I did. I came from a pretty low background. Obviously, there's people in this world who are in a worse situation, but that's what instilled that, like, always looking for something else, always looking for something that's free, or always looking for some way to get by, because it goes in that whole, even being like wasteful, right? So like wasteful wasn't just inconvenient, or it wasn't just wasteful. It was dangerous when you don't have a lot of money. So you're always looking for another angle, another avenue for income there.
That's a good point. I like that a lot. Wasteful is dangerous when you are low income, when you don't have any money, not low income, but you just don't have any money.
It's not just like, oh, well, that's wasteful. Like wasteful is being wasteful. It's like, it's actually dangerous.
Yeah.
Did you graduate then with any debt at all? Or was your kind of net position very positive when you graduated?
It's actually kind of funny. So I've always been extremely cheap, frugal, whatever. But
we pronounce that frugal here.
You're right. Yeah. I've always been efficient with my money. But I will say that going to college and getting those thousands of dollars of extra income was the first time I'd ever had money like that. And so I did make some bad decisions. But I still graduated college with probably about 10 grand in my pocket, maybe a little less. But I also had a 2005 Saline Mustang that I loved, and a Honda CBR motorcycle that I bought both of in cash while I was in college. So that was a total of about 18 grand worth of vehicles. Plus I probably had like a 10 grand in cash in the bank when I graduated.
Now, I'm not an expert in the military, but I do understand that at the academies, there's a career starter loan option. Was that offered to you during your experience?
It was. And I that's another thing about when you grow up on a lower income side of things, you are so scared of debt. Because
Can you explain this career starter loan and then what your decision-making process was around it?
Sure. Yeah. And we can probably get the exact rate, but the career starter loan is, I believe, for the Academy and ROTC. I know for us, it was around 25,000. There's something in my head that makes me believe in ROTC, it was somewhere around 25,000. For the Air Force Academy, I believe it's higher. And the idea is that you get that loan it's 0% interest for a certain amount of time, and then it's extremely low. Like I want to say 2% or less after that period of time. Now, when I look back on it now, I'm kicking myself. Why didn't I take this money? But when I was in that point to actually make that decision, I'm coming from this background, again, very low income, where debt is never a good thing. Like there was never a good debt story. There was never I didn't know anything about investing. I didn't know anything, whether it be stock market or real estate. I didn't know what you could do with that money that would be positive other than just saving it. And if I was going to save it, like why take the loan? So I did not take the loan. Obviously this is in around 2013 when I could have taken that money out. And if I would have invested $25,000, then it would have been a very nice chunk to change in my pocket. I could have made on interest, but I didn't take it.
Well, but would you have invested it?
If I would have taken it then, would I have invested it? No.
No. So then you're looking at it with 2019 eyes. But right. 2013 eyes, not taking the loan was a good choice because maybe you would have gone out and completed your collection of vehicles you don't need in a form of a truck. Or, I mean, you didn't have a truck. You just had a fancy motorcycle and a fancy car. So it's loans that you don't take out aren't necessarily a bad thing. It would have been nice, but, you know, I think it was a smart decision for 2013 you to not take that loan.
Correct. But if there's people out there who are seniors at the academy or about to graduate at RTC and you're smart and you feel comfortable with it and you believe in investing and you get that opportunity to take that investor loan, like learn from folks like me and take it, but use it wisely. Agreed. So many people took it and wasted it on something. And sure, it was a low interest loan, but they still just wasted it. So there is a lot of people who could take advantage of it if they get smart on investing.
So what does your position look like in the first couple of years out of college? And then what was the turning point where you kind of got serious about creating wealth, investing, working towards maybe financial freedom? What did that interim period like, and when did that transition point come?
Sure. So in college, I was going to school for computer engineering. So I actually did 5 years of college. That was an approved 5-year major for the Air Force. So they paid for all 5 years. So that would have had me graduating in 2013 at the age of 23. There was a big drawdown on the military at that time. So I was kind of in this holding pattern where they didn't have anywhere for me to go. So I was at home not getting paid for 7 months after I graduated. Finally got the notice that I was actually coming out to Colorado in December of 2013. So just about to turn 24 when I finally start working. And at that point, you know, I'm making probably around high 40s, maybe I think it was something like $48,000 a year. And to me, that was a lot of money. Like I'd never had any money, but I was also in this really weird spot where I was making money for the first time. I had achieved all the goals that I had. I graduated college. I got my commission. I got the location I wanted. Like everything should be perfect. But I realized I was unhappy and I mean, honestly, like depressed. Like I didn't have any other goals to go for. And I already had everything I wanted, but that just wasn't doing anything for me. And so I started kind of looking internally and realizing what stuff in my life was actually important and realizing that money wasn't what was making me happy and kind of refocusing my life. And then a year later in 2015 is when I really got serious about it. I kind of, you know, like everybody else, you stumble on the Mr. Money Mustache blog and you start thinking about like, oh man, I got all this extra money and I just don't think saving is the answer. There's got to be something else. And you start learning about investing. And so in 2015 is when I really started tracking every single thing I spent. It's when I created my giant spreadsheet. It's when I created the blog. And that's when I just really started getting serious about it and started trying to plan out like, what was it that I could do with my money and what would those and be more purposeful with my money.
So what was the first thing you invested in?
So again, from my background, there was no talk of investing. I was scared to death of investing. To everyone I grew up with, investing was like going to a roulette table. It was all a big gamble and you just didn't trust that system. But I finally got myself over the hump to where I believed that investing was safe, but I was still scared to like invest it myself. So I wasn't ready to just go straight up, open up a brokerage account at Vanguard and start picking funds. And I just started hearing about the robo advisors. And so I opened up a Betterment account. And that was my first foray into investing, was just simply feeding a Betterment account.
Hmm. What about, you know, it seems like you were frugal this whole time, right? Like throughout your whole life. When you kind of stumbled across these sites, started the blog, started your spreadsheet, did that kind of accelerate? Did that become more exaggerated? Did you become even more frugal and less spendy? Or was that just to kind of continue, you just kind of look at it and be like, hey, I'm going to continue what I'm doing here and it's pretty good?
So I think I did get better. And I think that's one of the reasons why some people don't like making a spreadsheet where they're putting down everything they spend. But it really helped me for no other reason than just seeing all those little tiny things that you were spending money on where you felt like you're being pretty frugal, but they were kind of starting to add up on you. Plus, I mean, I really didn't know. Like, I had no data to look back on. I had no idea how to make projections out forward, but it did make it much more, it made it more like purposeful. So I kind of, the analogy I think of is, you know, like when you're trying to train a dog and you're hitting it with a newspaper, like when I put numbers in my spreadsheet and I see my savings rate go down or I see like how much money that I have left to hit a goal go down, that is a visual reminder and that is very real. If I just have my stuff hooked up to Mint, and I look at it once every 3 months, like that's not going to change my habits. It might change someone else's habits, but that wasn't going to work for me.
Mm. Can you walk us through what your expenses are or are on an ongoing basis from this? Like, what do you pay for housing, transportation, food, or whatever categories that you've kind of broken out there?
Right. So currently I live just, you know, like right next to Cambridge. If you're familiar with Harvard, like I'm kind of in that area just outside of Boston. So most would consider this a very high cost of living area. I live on about $24,000 a year.
In Boston?
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Well, there's an entire post on there telling you exactly what I spent everything on in Boston. So you can get that one on the, hopefully in the show notes or definitely on the blog. But yeah, so my rent now, we found a great deal in a place. My half of the rent is $837.50 a month. That includes utilities. It's a two bedroom and it's got, you know, it's been redone completely on the inside. So I actually love our home. I don't have any car notes or loans of any type, really. I probably spend about $60 a month on gas. I spend a good bit on travel, you know, maybe anywhere from $300 to $500 on travel, maybe a couple hundred on random, maybe $100 or so of just something random that comes up that month. Maybe $100, $120 on going out, anytime, you know, whether that be like food, drinks, or even drinks like going over to someone's house. And then about $60 a month on my grocery expenses.
So how many roommates do you have?
So over the course of when I've been tracking this, you know, I've had roommates in the past. So I had a roommate in Colorado Springs, one roommate at times two. Then when I first moved to Boston, I had two roommates. And then now it's just me and my girlfriend. So it's just the two of us.
Is her part of the rent $837.50 too?
Yes.
Where do you live? Is it a studio?
No, it's a two bedroom. It's got a little balcony.
You have a two bedroom in Boston for $837. You should kiss your landlord.
It's $1,660, right? $1,660 is the rent, right?
Right.
Yeah, but for a two bedroom in Boston.
Yeah, this place is probably one of those, if they want to rent it quick, should have been like $2,100, and it's probably worth closer to $2,400.
Don't say that. It's worth $1,660.
Let's dive into that. You know, that's a great deal on the apartment for rent, but let's dive into that grocery budget, right? Because you're talking $60 a month, $15 a week, right? What are you eating on that kind of budget?
Beans and rice and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yeah, that's always my favorite question. I mean, my other favorite thing is how people say, like, they name things and I'm like, no, that's way too expensive. They're like, are you eating nothing but tuna? And I'm like, no, it's like $1 a can. I can't afford that. But no, so my staples are boneless, skinless chicken breast, eggs, milk, obviously like bread, rice, sweet potatoes, broccoli, green beans, all perishable stuff for the most part. So I'm not buying a lot of junk food. I'm not buying anything pre-made. I'm not buying sodas. I'm just buying meat and vegetables. And the other thing, and I've tried to put some stuff out there on the blog now where it's showing you kind of some principles I go by and some actual things I buy, but don't get hung up on the specific, this is what he bought, like, because what is on sale in your grocery store, what is on sale in my grocery store this week versus next week is going to change. It's kind of more about understanding those principles and the kind of things you're going to buy and being able to be flexible enough that when you're in the grocery store, you're getting what's on sale. You're not going in there with a, hey, I've got this list that says I am buying chicken or I am buying pork. Like, you can make the same thing with either one. Just get whatever's on sale.
That's a really good tip. I like that a lot. And I do like shopping the sales. We had Erin Chase on from $5 Dinners, one of our first episodes. And she said the same thing, shop the sales. Amy from Go With Less I was actually talking to her and she's like, oh yeah, I buy the meat and then I build around that based on what's on sale. But you go to the grocery store any given day, there's something that's dirt cheap.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of little tips. There's getting to know your specific local grocery stores, right? So they're going to have stuff that's going to be going out of date. So they got to get rid of it. So most grocery stores do that on a similar day. So for instance, I've got one, it's Sunday morning. So you get there Sunday early, the manager special area is stocked. And the great thing about meat is it's not going to go bad if you throw it in the freezer. And that's actually one of the, I made these little cooking commandments. And the first one is your freezer is sacred, because that freezer space should be just stocked full of every time you can find meat dirt cheap, unless you're a vegetarian, obviously. Like, that's what I'm using my freezer for. Like, it's not going to be full of all kinds of random boxes of stuff that take up a bunch of room. It's going to be nothing but straight, just dirt cheap meat that I find on sale.
let's go through these commandments. Can you rattle these off for us? I mean, it sounds like they're paying off for you if you're able to get such a low cost per meal, cost per week on your groceries. The first one is your freezer is, what was the term you just used?
Freezer is sacred.
The freezer is sacred. So the first one has, your freezer is sacred. Again, just because you got to have somewhere to store that stuff that's going to go bad when it's on sale, because you're never promised a sale tomorrow, you know. The second one I tried to have a little fun with was, I like big batches and I cannot lie. And so that just goes into, when you're doing this, like, do large amounts of cooking. So the reason most people don't meal prep and therefore spend so much money on eating is because it's not convenient for them. Because you don't want to clean up the kitchen every night, but that's why you know, the whole meal prepping thing, you cook a ton of stuff at once. We kind of touched on it earlier. The third one is, keep grocery lists generic. So if you need a grocery list, then you can think of it as, I need a protein, I need a vegetable. And then there's you need a vessel. So the vessel could be the rice or the tortilla or the bread or the thing that you kind of bring in a meal on top of. So you can make the same thing on rice or on tortillas or in a sandwich. So the kind of the vessel. But just keep those generic. I never make a list. I go to a grocery store and I'm like, I got a ton of meat in the freezer, but I don't have vegetables. Or I just think about the areas that I need. The fourth one is, avoid ingredients creep. So we talk about lifestyle creep or lifestyle inflation, but the same thing can happen on a meal. You pull up these recipes and they got 30 ingredients and they got these weird garnishes and they got these things that you honestly can't even taste. Like, start just pulling ingredients out of your recipes until you notice them decline. The same way we do with our financial lives, where we're saying, how do you know what deprivation is? And you start pulling stuff off until it hurts. And you say, okay, I went too far. Do the same thing with your groceries. Like, pull these random little things out of the recipe that you're not going to notice.
I love that because I very much love to experiment with recipes. And now I've got 37 different kinds of vinegar in the cabinet above my stove. It's rice wine vinegar and red wine vinegar, and they're different. And then there's, there's this white vinegar and there's that vinegar, and it's vinegar. It all tastes the same. It's gross.
And most meals are going to have a dominant flavor that you can put something else on top of. And some of it's even to some people, some of the ingredients I'm talking about would be blasphemy for you to cut out. So if you're making a taco, now granted, if I find cheese on sale, I'm going to buy cheese, I'll throw it on there. Try a taco without cheese. Let me know if you can tell that much difference, unless you're loading that bad boy down with cheese. There's a reason why when you go to Mexico, they don't come with cheese unless you ask for it. It's a separate thing. It's not just a given.
You can freeze cheese, FYI.
Yeah.
So if you find some on sale that isn't fuzzy.
But Justin's freezer is sacred and only for meat. No dairy in there.
The other two are, so number five is, I just put not really a grocery shopping thing, but it's kind of around that feeding yourself is hoard. So it is kind of grocery shopping too. Like the other day, I went to the store and they had these, the rice side things that are normally at least $1 a pack. They had them for 30 cents. I don't know how many they had, but I know I bought every one that they had. I was like, I don't know when I'm going to eat these, but I will. They had Reese's Puffs for $1.38 a box. I never can afford Reese's Puffs because they're $4 a box. So when they have them for $1.38 a box, I grabbed five of them. So just stock up on the stuff when it's really cheap. You'll eventually eat it. So you might have a month where your grocery bill is $100, but then the next month it's 20 because you've already just bought so much stuff cheap the month before. And then the last one is just getting to know those staples, those things you can always fall back on. So no matter what, I can always find chicken for $2 or less a pound. Eggs are always cheap. If things hit the fan, I can always just make something with eggs. You always have something you can kind of fall back on. So get to know those staples and make some meals around those.
Nice. That's a great list. And that application of that over the years has allowed you to get to that. Have you always been at a $15 a week average or $70 a month average? Or has that been something you've backed into in recent years after kind of honing this?
Yeah. So I've been keeping the spreadsheet for a little over 4 years, and that's my average across 4 years. And I would say that it's been pretty steady. It took a couple months initially, but once I figured it out early on, I've been able to maintain that. And I also say that to remember that I've lived in different places. So that works for me in Colorado Springs. It's working for me in Boston. So I can't guarantee it's going to work everywhere in the U.S. and especially not other countries, but this is not just some random little tiny town that has some weird grocery store. Like, these are big chain grocery stores in different cities that I've done this in.
In conjunction with this, I can only imagine the other things you're doing to keep your budget, you know, in line with that $24,000 annual expenditures. What's your savings rate overall as a percentage of your income?
So the average is right around is 75%, give or take. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower on a year. But it's, so I'm hardcore saving, like just cash, just over $69,000 a year, because I'm making right now in Boston just over $90,000 a year.
That's awesome.
After taxes.
What are you doing with that $69,000 a year?
So we have the TSP, or the Thrift Savings Plan, which is our form of a 401k. I max that. I max an IRA. And then that leaves me with 40 something thousand dollars left that I'm just throwing in a, like at VTI, mostly in a brokerage account.
Okay. So you're investing in index funds.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about real estate?
So I have, and I read the book on the investing in real estate out of state, because I just do not want to touch Boston.
When I think don't blame you.
Because like the house next to my mom's, they were, you know, I could buy that house for $50,000 and I could probably get pretty close to that 1% rule. I'm not touching, like, there's no way that I could get this apartment for $160,000 or, you know, there's no way I'm touching the 1% rule in this apartment. So I haven't gotten to real estate. I think that if I lived in a city, and I know I'm just making an excuse, but if I lived in a city where I could actually buy it local, that would help me get over that hump. I just haven't been able to get over that psychological hump of being remote.
I think that's valid. It's scary to invest in a thing that you can't even see. On the other hand, if you can't drive past it, you won't drive past it.
That's very true.
So you're not constantly out there and, ooh, they got, the weeds are an inch long. I'm going to call them up and, you know, but yeah, if you're not ready yet to invest in real estate, then, you know, now's the time to start learning about investing, learn how to screen a tenant, learn how to analyze a deal, learn how to do all these things. So when you are in a position to where you feel more comfortable, once you learn about it, it's a lot less scary to take the leap.
So I got an opinion here also that might be, you know, different, where if you're saving at 75% of your income like this, then it almost doesn't matter what you invest in, right? Because you're going to be so rapidly advancing towards that 25 times your savings rate, that 4% rule, that, I mean, what is the timeline to retirement, you know, at a 5% rate of return when you're saving 75% of your income? You know, it's got to be a matter of like less than 10 years, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm looking at too, is I could realistically, you know, retire. When you think about that kind of simple math behind retirement, I think it's a 7-8 years is what it would take saving that rate to be able to retire. And it kind of goes hand in hand with when I first started this blog. I started the blog for two reasons. One was because I realized, hey, I'm probably going to be retired younger than most of my friends, the way things are going. And I'd like to have some people to hang out with in retirement. So let's get them on board. That was rule number one. That was reason number one. Reason number two was, you know, I knew that I came from a poor background. I wasn't given any handouts from like my family to go to college. I was doing a job that anyone could get in the military pretty much. Like, this was not a fluke thing where I got in a startup company. I had the most like easy to follow in my eyes, like if you're willing to do it, path that you could have. I mean, like anyone could do this. And I'm thinking, this is going to be a good story, because I started it when I had $38,000. Like, and I could look out on the space and I could find people who had stories that maybe I could recreate, but they didn't start talking about it until they're already successful. And it's kind of one of those hindsight's 20/20, sure, it worked for them. But I wanted to start something where you could follow along from day one and be extremely transparent. So every month, you know, I'm putting the most detailed numbers I can put online without boring someone about my life and my spending. And so if this works, then I said it was going to work 4 years ago and you get to watch every step of the way. If it doesn't, then like, I'm going to look like an idiot, but hey, you know, here we are.
You said you had a very important sentence in there right in the beginning. You said, if you're willing to do the work.
Yeah.
You can't just do this. Oh, I want to be retired early. Why am I not retired early? Because you didn't do any work. It's not super hard work, but it is. I mean, you could have had another Shelby Cobra or Saline Cobra, Saline Mustang. Sorry, I'm getting all my cars confused. You could have had three more motorcycles and a truck and, you know, rented a house that costs a lot more than $1,600. You could spend $100 a week on groceries instead of $15. You can make a lot of choices to do dumb things with your money.
Or blown that career start alone.
Right. And that's what, there's a whole big, like, and I have no problem with it because I get it. There are certain people who are in situations that are just terrible and they maybe don't have a path to financial independence. But I do have a problem anytime I read online where somebody's like, I hate people just saying you can pull it up by your bootstraps and you can just figure this out. Because I'm like, well, I mean, I don't know what kind of handout I had. What advantage did I have? Like, please show me the advantage. I get it that I'm a, you know, I'm a white male in the United States. I get that. But I didn't get my job because of any of that. I didn't get my school paid for because of any of that. The money I have in my pocket has nothing to do with any of that. So again, coming from a, I graduated with 35 people at a public high school in Mississippi. Like, come on, guys. Like, you can do this.
And I got a question. Earlier you said it was 7 to 8 years to retirement, I think at a 75% savings rate. Is that right? How far away are you from retirement?
So by the numbers, I could be financially independent in at probably about the age 32. So like about 4 years, 3-4 years, because I started, that's from the day, you know, I started when I was 25. So that would put me in about 2022, 2023. Yeah. So anyways, about another 4 years should get me there because I'm 4 years in. I got 4 years to go.
Yeah. And let me point out something also that I think is remarkable with this. And you're doing all this without, I believe, one of the most powerful tools in the arsenal, which is that house hack, right? So think about if you're listening, think about the application of Justin's story. If you're in a market where house hacking is an option, right? It seems like Boston's not a really good one for you at this point because of the price point and the comfort zone, right? You wipe out that $800 a month in expenses and now you can spend double what Justin spends on groceries and still come out way ahead, you know, on that savings track, right? If you're in a similar life position. So what's remarkable is not only are you being extraordinarily efficient, but there's even more that could be done if you're thinking about this and you want to kind of repeat that journey to FI.
Absolutely. And that's the funny thing to me is, and we've talked a lot about the grocery part, and that is a lot of people struggle with that. When I have friends who are like, oh my goodness, how do you do this $60 a month grocery thing? Like, show me how. And I'm like, well, you also are paying $1,700 a month in rent. Like, I think that's probably a bigger problem than your grocery bill. So like by me keeping those core expenses, so housing is low for me. I mean, it's low for the area. My car expense is low, you know, keeping, and then my food budget low. I actually spend a ton of money on things that I don't need to spend money on. Like, I'm constantly going on trips. Like, all the time. So I'm always going on trips. There's a ton of stuff I could cut out and I'm still living on $24,000 a year while paying rent in Boston. Like, there's a lot of wiggle room here.
Yeah, I can relate to this as also, you know, being another 20 something, you know, man, and I don't have rent and my car is paid off and I'm not spending that much on food. And it's like, yeah, I feel like I have this like huge luxury pipeline of money flowing out of me on fun stuff. And I still just like, I can't spend that much money, right? Because of the design of those core things.
Yeah. Like, I literally don't know what spending $50,000 a year would look like. Like in my life without having kids or anything like that, I can't imagine what that would look like.
Yeah. Well, first you'd have to double your grocery bill.
then we still got about 20. Yeah. Then we still got like 24,000 left to go. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb.
Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Listen up, business owners. Here's some quick math. Fewer costs equals more profit. The problem? You're spending more than ever on operations, materials, deliveries, software, and more. So why not reduce your costs and headaches with NetSuite by Oracle? NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which means you can reduce IT costs with no hardware required. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. It makes sense that over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Don't let rising costs sink your business's growth. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/bpmoney. That's netsuite.com/bpmoney. netsuite.com/bpmoney.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting, from finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
So how did you find your apartment? Because we didn't finish this up before we moved on to food.
Right. So this is actually a pretty cool story as far as, I guess, the whole story, maybe not exactly how I found it, but I was living in a different apartment, the one where I had two roommates. This is before my girlfriend moved to Boston. I had renter's insurance through USAA. Again, shout out USAA. The floor above me catches on fire. Now, my apartment doesn't get much actual fire damage on my side of the building. It's mostly on the kitchen side, the back side, but everything was like smoke damage, and the roof is gone on the whole house. So you can't live there. So I'm like, okay. Like, you know, that's one of those things, you get home, you're like, I don't have anywhere to live. But luckily I had renter's insurance. And I start figuring out what is allowed in renter's insurance and what can you get. And they'll pay for your hotel. Well, they put me into a hotel, and the rule was they put me into a hotel for up to a year or until the house was fixed. Well, the house was not even beginning to be fixed. And so I ended up living in this hotel for 5 months. And now another thing a lot of people don't realize is they get a policy that says it's a $10,000 policy is what I had, like as cheap as I could get. I was spending over $8,000 a month on the hotel. Now that $10,000 is for your stuff. It is not for the displacement part. So I racked up over $40,000 worth of hotel bills. Now, the other thing I did was they called me and they're like, hey, we can put this under our name. That way we directly pay for it and you don't have to worry about it. And I said, no, thank you. Like, I'm going to get a real nice Hilton credit card. I want to put this on my credit card. And so I ended up with 2 million Hilton points.
Oh, my God. Remember, Scott, at the beginning of the show, he said he looks for ways to squeeze the most out of a dollar.
Oh my gosh, this is absurd.
So I'm sitting there with, and they were also paying for my groceries for a large majority of this. So anyways, I'm sitting there with 2 million Hilton points. And while I'm living in this hotel, right, they have free breakfast and I got a Homewood Suites on purpose because they also have free dinner Monday through Thursday. And I'm just taking Tupperware, filling stuff up. I'm spending $0 on groceries for those months. And then Leslie moves here. She actually lives with me in the hotel for a couple months. And, you know, start getting contacted from USAA and they're like, hey, like, you know, you've been in this hotel for so long, like the house is getting fixed. We're going to have to probably start looking to move you into like an Airbnb situation. And the only reason I liked living in the hotel was because I was getting all those points, because I wasn't making any money off of it, because I'm still paying my rent equivalent to USAA. So I'm not making any money, but I'm making so many of these points. And so once they started talking about moving me into Airbnb, I was like, okay, I need to find somewhere to live. And I was at the Grand Canyon and I get a phone call and it's this guy that I used to work with. And he's like, hey, I know a guy who's got a house. He's wanting to rent out a room in, and I know your house had a fire and maybe you should go look at it. And this is, I want to say July or August. And I said, sure. Yeah. I said, I not really want to move out real soon, cause I'm really loving making these points, but you know, maybe down the line. And then, once they started calling about the Airbnb thing, I called him and he still had the place for rent. And I come check it out and they've shown me the second floor and it's a huge apartment and he wants $2,100 a month for it. But it's straight like late 1800s, early 1900s. Everything is like very old school original. And I was like, well, this is actually still a pretty good value. You know, the utilities were included. But he's like, I got the third floor too. You might want to look at it, but it doesn't have a real kitchen. And I said, okay. Like I go upstairs, it's brand new. It's a little smaller, but still 2-bedroom. It's brand new and completely redone. Like you don't see stuff like this in Boston. And he's like, and I talked him down to $1,675 a month. And it was just like the greatest deal ever. And that's something I hate I didn't mention on the cooking thing. It was another one of the kind of excuses I try to expose is I don't even have like a range. I have a countertop oven. I have an Instant Pot. I have a portable electric stove, and I still do all of my meal prepping with that. But anyways, this apartment is like an accessory apartment, so it doesn't have an actual range. Even though it's a big kitchen, it doesn't have a dishwasher or a range.
So wait, you do all of this? You cook all of your meals, it sounds like you eat most of your meals at home.
Mm-hmm.
Or make
make all my meals at home, yeah.
You do this in a kitchen that doesn't even have a stovetop.
Yeah, so I actually discovered the love of an Instant Pot while I was in the hotel, because once they stopped paying for my groceries, even though they had the free food in the hotel, like it's not the healthiest stuff and it just kind of gets to you after a while. So I started wanting to cook some meals and didn't really have a good way of doing it. So discovered the Instant Pot. That helps a lot. Also, they make some pretty big kind of countertop ovens. They make some that can fit like a full-size pizza that's got 2 racks. You can't, like, I definitely can't do meal prep quite as efficiently as I used to, because when I lived in a normal house, man, I had these cheap pans that I would get that were the exact, like, as big as you could possibly fit in an oven on each rack. And I would just do 6-7 pounds of chicken, 6-7 pounds of sweet potatoes, and all, you know, several pounds of greens, all, like green vegetables all at the same time, you know, throw the oven on 450 and go watch an episode of Game of Thrones. And then you come back and all your food's done for the week. So now it's a little more involved. I'm having to do some stuff in the Instant Pot while I'm doing some stuff in the oven, but it's still pretty efficient.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If you're spending a lot of money on groceries and you want to stop, listen to this episode and ditch your excuses, because Justin doesn't even have a stove.
Yeah, and I put the blog post out there where it's kind of like, I try to make one where it's walking you through some of those excuses people come up with and trying to counter those. I also put like a picture of my kitchen setup, so you can see where I just have my little oven and my little Instant Pot. So there's some photos in there. Some other excuses you'll hear that I kind of want to touch on was time, right? Everyone complains that even if it's on a money thing, like they just don't have time to cook. And my counter is always, well, okay, so if you went out to eat every time you never cook, that's supposed to save you time and you're getting it to go. That takes you 15 minutes to go get it. You do that 5 days a week. You know, that's 2.5 hours a week that you're spending going and getting to go stuff. I can promise you it does not take me 2.5 hours to cook 5 days worth of meals for myself. Promise you that. It takes maybe my Instant Pot stuff. I'm spending like 10 minutes worth of work to put in the Instant Pot, and that takes maybe 20, 30 minutes, and that's running in parallel with the oven that's maybe going to take me 45 minutes to an hour. So you're talking about an hour of your total time and only maybe 10, 20 minutes of work. And I've got 5 days worth of food versus spending 2.5 hours driving around to different restaurants and getting to go stuff. So I would argue that it doesn't save you time.
No, it does not save you time.
Yeah, the time saving is immense when you have every meal planned for the whole week and know what you're going to be doing and don't have to scramble for it and think about it and all that kind of stuff, not to mention the costs.
Right. But for some reason, like that is, I would say just, you know, they'll say convenience and then they'll say time are the two biggest reasons why people refuse to cook.
It's not convenient to go out to dinner every single time. No. What if, let's say it takes you, let's say the thing is right over there. The restaurant is right over there. You still have to drive over there. You have to get in the car, especially if you have kids. You got to get in the car. That's like 10 minutes. You drive over there. You walk in the door. You tell them how many people, they make up your table. Then they sit you down. Then your waitress comes over. And it's not an easy transition. It's not an easy or short experience. I mean, even if you're going through the drive-through, that's still like 10 or 15 minutes. It's just, it's not as easy as you think it is. And when you sit down and really think, how much time does it take me? You'll be surprised at how much time it takes you.
And no matter what you get, it's unhealthy.
Yeah. And there's also things that you can do to keep shrinking that time it takes you to prep your food. So when I throw something in the oven, I'm always putting tinfoil down. I'm not washing that thing. I just pop it in the trash. And then now with the Instapot, like I don't have to do rice and this and that and different things all in the Instapot. So I'm washing like one bowl, throwing the tinfoil away, and washing my knife and cutting board, done. Like it's not a bunch of work. Like I don't know how people dream up all this work, but it's not much work.
Yeah, the Instant Pot seems expensive. It's like $199-ish. You can find it for maybe like $150, whatever. It seems like it's a really expensive thing for this little, oh, I already have a rice cooker. I have a slow cooker. No, and if you want to do all of these things, get yourself an Instant Pot, find it when it's on sale, or just spend the money. You will not believe how fast it, I mean, this stuff cooks like that. It's an instant. And then, look at that. I didn't.
This episode's famous for is brought to you by Instapot.
Instapot.
But I think I got it's mine amazing. For, I think I got mine for like 60 bucks, 50 something bucks. 60.
I got mine for free because my company bought it for me for Christmas.
Oh, nice.
And I didn't even want it. When they were offering us, they're like, oh, here's three things to choose from for your Christmas gift. I'm like, oh, I have that. I don't want that. I guess I'm going to get an Instant Pot. And then I got it and it was in the box for like a month. And then I finally opened it up for something. And I'm like, this is the best thing ever. And I still kept my slow cooker because that works in a different way. Although the Instant Pot has a slow cooker setting. But yeah, no, I love the Instant Pot. I can make anything in there in a heartbeat and it's fabulous.
And if you have a full size oven, again, just get a giant sheet pan, just throw meat, vegetables on it, and you can throw sweet potatoes on a rack, close your oven, go watch Netflix, come back, your meal prepping is done. Throw the tinfoil away, there's no cleanup. Like it's
yeah, you don't have to watch it cook.
Yeah.
Okay. You have mentioned a ton of articles that we are going to link to on our show notes, which can be found at biggerpockets.com/moneyshow75. That's moneyshow75. Okay, Justin, are you ready for our famous four questions?
I hope so.
I hope so too, because they are difficult to answer. Oh, I'm sorry. Four questions and one command.
Okay.
And you're a military man, so you can follow commands. What is your favorite finance book?
Right. So my favorite finance book, and it's maybe from a different angle because it's not for myself, but again, I'm trying to help people and show them a very relatable and easy way to get to personal finance and introduce them to things. So I love using Aaron Lowry's Broke Millennial book to give to people when they're kind of just getting started.
That's a great one. And she's got a second one out on investing that we're going to interview her about sometime.
Nice.
Love it. There's a good chapter in that book featuring some topics about house hacking. So.
Oh, wow. I wonder who she interviewed about that.
Yeah, I love that book. Love Broke Millennial and Aaron. So, all right. What was your biggest money mistake?
So I would say it was as soon as I graduated college, again, making money for the first time, I bought a, even though it was a year used, this sounds terrible. This is like, so it's like the saddest, worst money mistake. So I bought a used hybrid car. That was my worst mistake. So it was a 2013 Ford Fusion hybrid. In my whole life, I'd always done really great at being able to buy a car and sell it for like almost exactly what I bought it for. And this car is definitely going to, I'm going to lose a lot of appreciation on it. But that was my worst money mistake.
Do you still have it?
Yeah.
So why are you going to lose?
Shake my head.
If it still runs, run it into the ground.
I know, but still, like, I had always bought like a car, drove it for 3 years and sold it for almost exactly what I bought it for, because I would buy like these really sweet spot, you know, in the car buying life cycle. And then this one I bought, it was only a year old. You buy a car that's 4 years old and you can do pretty well on it. You buy a car that's 1 year old and not so much.
Not so much. Justin, what is your best piece of advice for people who are just starting out?
So my favorite little thought experiment I always give to people, and this kind of goes in line with the grocery, but it's bigger than that, is you ask somebody, what did you have to eat last Tuesday? Normally, most people cannot answer that question. And then you follow that up with, what was the last like memorable vacation or concert that you went to? And you see their eyes light up and they get all excited about it. They start telling you about it. And they're like, what were those two questions all about? And you're like, well, you know how you couldn't remember what you ate for lunch last week? Anything in your life that you can't remember a week later, cut or minimize that as much as possible. Those things that make your eyes light up and smile, focus your money on those.
That is great advice. That might be the best one I've ever heard.
That is awesome.
I want to get a shirt that just says, what'd you have to eat last Tuesday or something like that. It's like an inside joke, but...
But yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, I guess I do know what I ate last night because my husband cooked it and it was...
No, not night. Last night, last Tuesday.
Yeah, I can't I remember what I ate two days ago Tuesday.
All right, what is your favorite joke to tell at parties?
My favorite joke to tell at a party is, because much like my co-host, I love a good dad joke, is, what do you call it when Batman skips church?
Oh, I don't know.
Christian Bale.
Oh, no.
Okay. From time to time, our listeners will send us in a joke. So Alan Bishop sent in, which American president was the least guilty? Abraham Lincoln. He was in a cent.
Oh, man.
That's a nice
fantastic. There it is.
And for the carnivorous plant lovers out there, tomorrow I am going to see the carnivorous plant exhibition at the Royal Botanical Gardens. I wonder if I'll be allowed to take a picture. Pitcher plants are a carnivorous plant. When Carl and I got married, we got married at the Olbrich Conservatory in Madison, Wisconsin, and we took our pictures on the inside, and they have this huge carnivorous garden section, and we made sure to take our pictures there because he's a big carnivorous plant fan. Plus, they're cool-looking plants.
Yeah, they are cool-looking.
Okay, are you ready for the command? What is your rank? What is your military rank?
I'm a captain, which is in the Air Force is a 03. So on the officer side, it's kind of your third rank up on the officer side.
Captain Taylor, tell us, where can people find out more about you, sir?
If you just Google Saving Sherpa, I feel like that's much easier than actually typing in a URL because it does have a hyphen in it. But just Google Saving Sherpa, I'll be the first link. You can find me there. You can also listen to me and Cody weekly on Tuesdays at thefyshirt.com. And I'm on all the social medias at Saving Sherpa, but you can get to that through the blog.
Awesome. Well, we will include a link to all of that in our show notes again, which can be found at biggerpockets.com/moneyshow75. Okay, Justin, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to share with us your recipes and tips. And just, this was really fun. We have a lot of things here.
I appreciate you guys having me on because, you know I don't have the craziest story where I started some business or whatever, but, you know, I think it's cool to have somebody that anyone can follow.
Yeah, you know what? That's the thing. We want repeatable stories. It's great that somebody won the lottery for $900 million. How many times does that happen? So far, one. And that would, they even had to split it up. So, I mean, it's not a repeatable thing. Oh, wow, they won the lottery. I better go out and buy all these tickets all the time. Oh, I kept losing. So, no, this is great. This is exactly what we want. Somebody who has a story that somebody else can do too.
Yeah, and you're so aggressive about it. I mean, it's just fantastic. You're so aggressively pursuing this thing while making those memories and having the good life. You know, you're just not having the glamorous meal last Tuesday that you don't remember.
I always joke with people that I am on like the laziest path to FI because I don't have side hustles. I'm not doing real estate. Like I'm not doing anything crazy. Like I'm not climbing a corporate ladder, but I'm on a pretty fast track. So you don't necessarily have to be the entrepreneur that we get used to in this space. I mean, I wish I was. I wish I could get more into that. I'd love to. But right now, so far, I'm on about the laziest path you can be to FI.
And that's what we'll call this episode, The Laziest Path to FI with Justin Taylor.
I love that title.
I do too. Do you feel deprived, Justin?
I'm in a nice two-bedroom apartment in Boston. Like I said, I'm traveling this weekend. I'm constantly flying somewhere on the road. And I also still have money in my budget to give to good causes. I sponsor, you know, a kid down in Mexico and at an orphanage I go visit every year. Like I feel like I'm getting to both help others and live an awesome life. And I've wrapped that up in a $24,000 bucket and I can't feel deprived one bit.
Well, I can't top that. Okay. From episode 75 of the Bigger Pockets Money podcast, this is Justin and Scott and Mindy, and we are out. The market is changing, and finding your way can be tricky. Rates shift, headlines whirl, but your goal hasn't changed. You want financial freedom, and the best investors know it's not about timing the market, it's about time in the market. If you're ready to get into real estate investing or take it to the next level, finding an investor-friendly agent is your next step. With the Bigger Pockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in minutes. Just head to biggerpockets.com/deals, enter a few details about what and where you want to buy, and boom, instantly matched with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all host and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.